DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, digging deep in the worlds of science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani. And coming up, double-dipping doping at the Paralympics in London, including the little-known technique of boosting.
It's a performance enhancer, and it's also a health risk, as a autonomic dyslexia can cause heart attack or stroke. So that's why it's outlawed by the IPC.
Also on the programme, the future of the future from the IFA trade fair in Berlin and the second part in our Grinberg Method special. All that and more right here on Spectrum. But first, you might have caught a little irony in the past day or so with Paralympic running favourite Oscar Pistorius complaining about the alleged unfair advantage of a fellow competitor in the T44 200 metres race. On Sunday night, Pistorius lost his title rather bitterly to the Brazilian Alan Oliveira. He's since apologised, but had accused Oliveira of wearing non-regulation carbon prosthetics. Basically, Pistorius had said that they were too long. This coming from a man who, despite his disabilities, had fought for and won his right to compete in the Olympics, where he faced accusations from others in the able-bodied world that he, the double amputee, had had an unfair advantage himself because of his carbon prosthetics. Well, whether it's the Olympics or Paralympics, technology is now becoming increasingly important and divisive in athletics. The many advancements in technology have given rise to what some people are calling techno-doping. Here's Charlotte Lomas.
Watch Oscar Pistorius in lane two. He's nursing his injury, but
Oscar Pistorius embodies the spirit of the Olympics and Paralympics. The South African was born without fibulas or calf bones and had both his legs amputated as a baby. But he devoted himself to athletics and, using carbon prosthesis, Pistorius became a top-ranking athlete in disabled sports and even won the right to compete in able-bodied sports events. At the London Olympics, Pistorius made it to the 400-metre semi-finals. Some cheered his success as a step toward equal rights for athletes. But others said the fact that he'd been allowed to compete at all was a scandal. Some even spoke of techno-doping.
It's an absurd and unsporting argument. It simply ignores the fact that these people train too. The technical support that the athletes get is more like leveling the playing field.
That's Rüdiger Herzog. It's his job to advocate mechanical progress. He works near the German city of Göttingen, where his employer Otto Bock is a world leader in prosthetics and has organised maintenance workshops at the Paralympics since 1988. He's in London for this year's Paralympics with 80 engineers who will carry out all repair work for the athletes free of charge, whether it's fixing wheelchairs, broken bats or prosthetic knee joints. Herzog wants to dispel the notion that disabled athletes only win because of the technology and the equipment they use. He says research into medical devices focuses more on improving the lives of disabled people than on the much smaller sports market.
There are prostheses that are controlled by microprocessors. Some systems are highly technologically sophisticated, but all this gear is not allowed in sports because it needs its own power supply, which is generally excluded.
The United Nations wants full inclusion. It wants people with disabilities to be able to take part in everyday society in every way. In sports, that means breaking down the barriers in competition. Hubert Hüpper is a German federal government commissioner responsible for the interests of disabled people.
For me, inclusion in sports means that wherever possible, we should bring disabled and able-bodied athletes together so that one day the Olympics and Paralympics are merged into one event. Even just bringing the events closer together is important.
Oscar Pistorius is not the first athlete to participate in both the Olympic and Paralympic Games, but has been the one to reignite the debate over inclusion. But the Games have very little to do with many people's everyday lives. And even some of the athletes, when they return home after the competition, will return to countries that lack the medical and technical infrastructure they need.
Charlotte Lomas with that report by Ronnie Blaschke. Well, as you might expect, officials at London's Paralympic Games are doing what they can to stop athletes cheating. And this year, they're not just testing for the usual banned substances like steroids and other known stimulants, but they're also keeping an eye out for a practice known as boosting. Jesse Wingard has more from London.
Intense physical exercise automatically raises the heart rate and blood pressure in able-bodied athletes. But sports people with disabilities, like severe spinal cord injuries, don't get that natural boost. Here's Craig Spence of the International Paralympic Committee.
Boosting involves athletes with a high spinal cord injury inducing pain, and this causes something called autonomic dysreflexia, which effectively means they increase their heart rates, which obviously then means faster blood levels, and that can increase the oxygen capacity of their muscles.
Autonomic dysreflexia, or boosting, causes an athlete to get a rapid rise in blood pressure, giving them a sudden rush of energy. Dr. Peter van der Velde, Medical and Scientific Director at the International Paralympic Committee and anti-doping program member, says boosting is achieved when athletes expose the lower part of their body to painful stimuli.
Athletes will strap themselves very tightly in their chairs, or they will compete with a full bladder, which gives a signal. You and I, when we have a full bladder, we get the signal that we need to go to the toilet. In this case, they will ignore that signal. So that means the signal goes that you need to go to the toilet, but then the response is not the one that they do. They don't go to the toilet, so that response boosts their system. Now, athletes learned that response also allowed them to excel in performance, that they can increase their performance up to 10%. You can compare it by getting into an excited state, so that can be comparable to adrenaline.
New Zealand wheelchair rugby team member and Paralympic gold medalist Dan Buckingham says boosting is common in Paralympic sport, but says it can occur involuntary with paraplegic competitors.
When something happens where their bladder needs to empty, whatever, they get a sudden spike in blood pressure and heart rate, so instantly your performance improves. And of course, I experienced it. Every time I needed to go to the toilet, my blood pressure would go up, and it's instant, and it is magic. Suddenly you can just push so much faster. But it's involuntary, you know, it just happens. And of course, it's an uncomfortable feeling, so you deal with it. It's the players that really push it to the limit, and you can see, you know, their skin starts goosebumping and they start sweating and they're intense, you know, a little too intense.
Asked whether he's ever considered consciously using boosting to get an edge on competitors, Buckingham says there have been times when he has had no choice.
I think when I was, yeah, definitely intense games, it can be a big call to pull yourself off the court, to call for a sub when you're in a situation where it's coming down to the last minute of the play and you can feel something coming on and you know you're getting a boost. And I'm sure there's times when I have pushed through it. I don't think it affected me that much. I think it's more, so in the big games, sure, I've probably pushed through it, but not to an extent where it's going to win the game or make a huge difference.
Boosting is banned by the International Paralympic Committee, and not only for fair competition. Craig Spence again.
It's a performance enhancer, and it's also a health risk, as autonomic dysreflexia can cause heart attack or stroke. So that's why it's outlawed by the IPC.
Blanket testing is in place for Paralympic events where athletes might be tempted to boost. Spence says anti-doping testing officials are on the lookout for symptoms of boosting, such as having a red face or sweating before a race. Athletes displaying these symptoms will be tested for high blood pressure, and if they fail two tests, they will be barred from the race as a health precaution. But more traditional forms of doping are just as much a problem as boosting at the Paralympics as they are in the Olympics and other elite sporting events. IPC Medical Director Peter van der Velde says Paralympic athletes have also been known to take banned substances.
We see anti-doping rule violations in the broader spectrum for anabolics. We see the misuse of stimulants. There is the category of diuretics. And very unfortunately, we have the occasional case of cannabis and marijuana, which we would call the social drugs. They're prohibited.
New Zealand Paralympian Dan Buckingham says willingly stimulating the body in any way is cheating, and anyone doing it should be sidelined.
When at some stages it seems obvious that people are doing something to aid their performance and you put in all the hours of hard work and someone else is coming through and it's just like, man, you know, you just feel cheated.
The IPC's Craig Spence says the aim, as at all games, is for the Paralympics at London 2012 to be clean of drugs and boosting.
We want the best athletes to win. We don't want cheats to win. Cheats should not succeed in sport. We want the athletes who have trained for 4 years naturally with the best talent to win gold here, not the cheat.
Jesse Wingard, DW, London.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
The International Funkausstellung, or IFA, is one of the world's largest consumer electronics fairs. This year, more than 1,400 exhibitors have been showing their latest gadgets and some of the things that will be on the shelves, no doubt, before this year's Christmas trade starts. There are hundreds and hundreds of stands at the Berlin Messe, but Chipondo Cimbelu found himself being drawn away from the audio section and an array of snazzy headphones to some altogether far more futuristic stuff that we might have to wait a little longer for.
For most consumers, headphones are the trend. The bulky accessories, which once lost ground to smaller in-ear phones, have long been back. But they now look like they are here to stay. There are even cordless ones, powered by Bluetooth. But some visitors have got their eyes on other things.
A golden TV with real gold.
Normally, you only see tablets here. Everyone got a new tablet, and to be honest, they're all similar.
Speakers that would hang from the ceiling that looked like lighting systems.
A sewing machine with a screen.
Maybe the 8K full HD.
But I found this handheld massage device far more surprising and rather pleasant. It's made of four sets of soft plastic prongs which turn and massage the scalp, and it's quite relaxing. And its Japanese manufacturer, Panasonic, claims it improves the health of the skin on the head. And if you're in Europe, you should be able to try one yourself later this year. Elsewhere, Samsung has presented its first smartphone using the new Windows mobile operating system, and Hewlett-Packard has unveiled a hybrid product combining a tablet computer and a tuck-away keyboard. But if the near future isn't enough, for those willing to fork out an extra €49, the IFA-hosted TEDx conference is where the far future was at. It's where leading thinkers, artists, and innovators were invited to share their visions of the future. Mexican researcher and professor of artificial intelligence at the Free University of Berlin, Raul Rojas, was one of them.
We have been developing an autonomous car at the university. That means the car is like a taxi. So you just step into the car, you tell the car where you want to go, and then the car takes you there without you having to drive the car.
How does it work?
Well, it works like a human driver does it. A human driver has two eyes and hands and feet. Hands and feet are for accelerating, braking, or moving the steering wheel. In our case, we have additional motors that are integrated in the car, and the computer can tell the car to brake, to speed, or to move the steering wheel.
Raul Rojas says there are only two places in the world where self-driving cars are being tested on public roads, California and Berlin. Rojas is dreaming of a world where we can call up these self-driving cars from anywhere. They would be part of a smart city in which all resources are used efficiently by everyone.
Public acceptance will take also many years to get because we will need hundreds of thousands or millions of driven kilometers to show that the technology is even safer than a human. And then when people see this, they will accept the technology.
It's also unclear who would take responsibility for an accident, the car maker or the programmer. It's just one of the questions that need to be answered before self-driving cars can be produced for the market. It could take another 40 years, although we've already seen them in sci-fi films for about the same amount of time. But the other question is whether people will really want them. TEDx speaker Ulrich Reinhardt from the Foundation for Future Studies in Hamburg.
New possibilities do not automatically change the behavior of the people, and that there's a big gap in, for example, the hardware and the soft skills the people actually need. The people do not change their behavior on short notice. They stick to their behavior. And simply because we have new possibilities does not automatically means that people are really using it, especially if we look at the demographical factor in Europe, more and more old people. And of course, the technology is simply technology.
Most of the gadgets at IFA are aimed at the market as it stands today. But the sheer plethora of electronics is mind-boggling. These days, smartphones can be used underwater and speakers can be built into walls. Whether people really need all of these options is in doubt. Ulrich Reinhardt again.
If we really look at the use, what the people do with the mobile phones, for example, the smartphones, they basically use it, of course, to get into the internet and to post some new posts on Facebook, and etc., and to simply get into contact with others. But the chances that actually a mobile phone offers to the people are not that often used by the people. It's more having the phone and having the chance to use it.
So there could be an argument for investing time into educating consumers rather than simply giving them more options on their phones and other gadgets, which they are unlikely to use. Rahul Rojas suggests the responsibility for educating consumers lies with the producers.
Optimizing is done by the industry, by commercial producers. And thinking ahead, thinking in terms of 20, 30 or 40 years, is what research is doing. And that's what the universities expect us to do, to think farther ahead than commercial companies. That's why I think it's a division of labor. Commercial companies do the final tuning, the optimization, and we do the thinking ahead.
Possibilities are endless, and things that were once sci-fi visions are becoming reality. The question is whether the industry will give us products that we actually use and need. Chipona Chimbelu for DW in Berlin.
Well, you might still think it's summer in Europe, but you'd be kidding yourself because the mood is slowly turning to autumn. And with it comes the first of the latest research into the flu virus. My English teacher used to tell us that coughs and sneezes spread diseases. It was some kind of a line from the war, I think. But a new study has just suggested that influenza could be transmitted even before such symptoms as coughs and sneezes or runny nose appear. So if you've just sneezed, chances are you've already spent the past 24 hours spreading the virus without knowing it. The findings of the report could have implications for the prevention of seasonal flu epidemics as well as pandemics like the 2009 swine flu outbreak, which killed around 300,000 people. I spoke to co-author Dr. Kim Roberts.
With some of our previous work, we observed that we could get transmission quite early and that we weren't seeing the severe coughs and sneezing fits that you might expect if that was necessary for influenza virus transmission. So we wanted to explore that relationship between symptoms and the efficiency of flu transmission.
And so what exactly have you done here? You've used ferrets to track the rate of transmission or the point at which flu virus is transmitted.
We used a small animal model so that we could control the experiment, so that we could define when our naive animals were exposed. So we used ferrets because they get infected by the same sorts of flu viruses as we do, and they show similar sorts of symptoms. So they cough, they sneeze, they have a fever and a runny nose. And ferrets have been used for decades to study influenza virus infection, and they really are considered to be the gold standard small animal model for this sort of work.
So it really is reliable. I mean, or they are really reliable as an indicator for behaviour in people.
They give us some information. Obviously, without doing exactly the same study in people, it's very difficult to know how much of the information is exactly the same, how much we can apply the ferret data to humans. But it's the best small animal model that we have.
So run us through what you actually did. You infected some ferrets and then you added non-infected ferrets.
Yes. So we infected some ferrets. And then at different times during their infection, we exposed some uninfected ferrets for short periods of time. So this allowed us to determine whether or not one of the naive animals caught the virus very early on in the initial animal's infection or later on towards the end of the infection. So it allowed us to define that transmission period.
So whenabouts do you, I mean, usually the symptoms appear, what, about 48 hours into infection?
Yes, so with the ferrets, we monitored their body temperature so we could determine when they developed a fever. And they developed a fever at about 45 hours after infection, and they started sneezing at about 48 hours after infection. But what we found was that we could get efficient transmission of the virus after just 24 hours of infection. So that's really early on. That's before the infected animals are showing a fever, before they're sneezing.
And it should be said that you used the same strain of flu that caused the swine flu pandemic in 2009, which resulted in huge numbers of deaths. Does that also have a bearing on your results here? I mean, if we think about the normal seasonal flus, are they going to have the same sort of impact, the same sort of effect as something like the swine flu?
We chose the 2009 virus because that was the virus that was circulating at the time that we were doing the work, and because we wanted to use a virus that we knew transmitted efficiently within the human population when the human population hasn't been exposed to the virus, because that's what we're modelling with the ferrets, because the ferrets haven't seen influenza virus before, so this is their first time that they've had a flu infection. So the ferret data tells us something about how highly transmissible new viruses spread amongst the population. But the seasonal viruses might be a bit different because obviously we'll have had previous years' exposure to those viruses, and so there might be different dynamics for those viruses.
But we are still talking about a scale that could have serious implications for the prevention of whether it is seasonal flu epidemics or pandemics, such as in 2009. What do you think are the implications? I mean, does this really mean that it's absolutely impossible now to stop the spread, the rapid spread of influenza?
I think the data from this study supports the observations that were made during the 2009 pandemic, where various methods were put in place to try and slow down the spread of the disease. And I think it's very clear that it's very, very difficult to stop the spread of influenza infection. And really, prevention is our best strategy. So that means good vaccines and people taking up the vaccines and good monitoring of the viruses that are circulating so that we can be prepared for what might be around the corner.
Right, so it's not just a case of covering your nose if somebody else sneezes on the tram or bus into work. It's a case of getting prepared and prevent the spread before you even get infected, right? Or anybody around you does, right?
Yes, it's about being aware that once you have the symptoms, you've probably passed the virus on to other people already.
Dr. Kim Roberts, virology lecturer at Trinity College Dublin and co-author of a new report into the spread of the flu virus, which is led by Professor Wendy Barclay at Imperial College London. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, also follow us at DW_SciTech. Well, in last week's programme, we looked at how the teaching discipline, the Grinberg method, helps people deal with physical pain. This week, it's time to look at Grinberg and fear. We tend to avoid things that scare us. It's just the way we are. But when bad things do happen, they often have a lasting impact on our lives, whether it's a car crash, an abusive relationship, the death of a loved one, or dealing with personal failure. All these things can affect our confidence and our relationships with others. Unlike talking therapies, the Grinberg method teaches people to recognize how certain events were experienced by their bodies at the time and how they can respond in a different way now. In Berlin, here's Cinema Nippard.
Before she found the Grinberg method, Anna Schmutter had tried Qigong, Tai Chi, yoga, homeopathy and cognitive behavioral therapy. Schmutter says all these disciplines and therapies helped her up to a point, but that the Grinberg method has given her more practical tools to gain strength and clarity in her life.
When I started, I felt much more victim of circumstances in many situations than I do feel now. I have so many tools now, and it's just not an option for me anymore to see myself as weak.
Schmutter became a Grinberg practitioner herself and recently completed a course called Strong at the Broken Places, which aims to help people deal with traumatic experiences they had as children. While traditional psychology and psychiatry focus on a person's history and retelling the story of what happened, the Grinberg method aims to help people identify how stressful events were originally experienced by the body and how those events continue to manifest themselves in bodily reactions. For example, if you're afraid of crowds and you find yourself hyperventilating, talking about the original cause of the fear is unlikely to change the way you react to it. But Grinberg practitioners say becoming aware of your bodily reactions and where they come from will let you overcome the fear. Anna Schmutter.
It's not so important to know why did it happen, when did it happen exactly, who was involved. It's enough that you will pay attention to what happens today and to notice how much you can change this today.
Varad Manasa has been a Grinberg practitioner for 20 years. She's also a trainer and teacher and runs the International Grinberg School in Berlin with Claudia Glovic. Manasa developed the course Strong at the Broken Places after meeting so many people, like Anna Schmutter, who've gone through traumatic experiences in childhood.
It's not that we are teaching a person to be confident, but we know that if they will stop their insecurities, they will be naturally confident. So if I'm looking at people that went through abusive trauma in childhood, it's not that I have to teach them to be stronger, but I have to teach them how to stop becoming insecure in certain situations, or how to stop to interpret a situation today as if it's something that happened in the past.
But the Grinberg method isn't just useful for people dealing with past traumas. Just as it teaches people how to recognise and stop their automatic reactions to physical pain, this technique of stopping or breaking ingrained habits and routines can be applied to any situation that's painful or scary. Varad Manasa.
Later on in life, many people design their own life in order to avoid either fear or pain or both these kind of forces. And what we are trying to teach people, that when they are afraid today, they will not be afraid of fear itself.
Manasa's colleague, Claudia Glovic, also heads the International Association of Grinberg Practitioners. Glovic says that the learning process is not a replacement for medical treatment or psychological help.
If we see that we don't manage to work with a certain topic, or let's say a person comes to us in a physical condition that actually requires medical treatment, or it doesn't allow them to learn anymore, we always refer them to professional help. I mean, it's very clear for us, we are a teaching method.
This mode of training isn't appropriate for everyone. It's a participatory process that requires attention, awareness, and action from the client. The Grinberg method teaches people to communicate honestly and directly, something Anna Schmutter has found very useful.
The Grinberg method is not like a recipe against fear, or that you will never be insecure again in your life, but actually what you learn is that you take responsibility for yourself in whichever situation you encounter in your life, and this means a lot of independence and a lot of self-responsibility and also self-discipline.
Josefa Conrad, a Berlin-based musician who started a one-on-one process, can already see changes in the way she deals with physical and emotional pain. But she also knows the Grinberg method is not a silver bullet for all the crazy stuff life can throw at you.
You know, there's no way to go through life without getting sick or the flu or having some violent encounter with a bacteria or a virus. I think it's great to train oneself to what do I do when things kind of go wrong. And so I'm really excited to learn more productive ways of experiencing the very dangerous world out there.
Berlin-based Grinberg client Josefa Conrad, ending that report by Cinema Nippard. And there's more on the Grinberg method online at dw.de/science. That's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at that website. That's dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfi Karabani. Studio tech was Thomas Schmidt. Coming soon on Spectrum, smart robots. Perhaps we might even throw in a few smart humans. You never know. Hope you can make it then. Thanks for listening and bye for now. So this life belongs-